This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jinyi Lee from the University of Arizona. In today's episode, we welcome Professor Puck Brecker. Puck is a historian of early modern Japan, teaching and researching at the Washington State University. Actually, Puck did an interview with our channel last year on his previous book about autonomy in Japanese history. This time, Puck returns with his brand new book, Animal Care in Japanese Tradition, A Short History. It was recently published by the Association of Asian Studies in their Asia Shorts series. So this book provides a historical overview of how Japan has trained, controlled, and used animals. Situating Japan's relationship with animals in its historical and social context, this book identifies similarities between the Japanese animal care and the West, and interrogates the term tradition that's been used to describe this history. So welcome back, Puck. It's good to see you again.
Thanks, Jingyi. It's great to be here.
Thank you. You've obviously been busy since our last chat popped up another book so soon. And this topic, the topic of this book is quite different from your previous one. So how did you come to write on this one? How did your projects develop? And is this book connected with your previous works in any way?
Yeah, so I think it's common to research and want to write about what you have an interest in, a personal interest in. The topic of my last book, which you just mentioned, on private spheres and autonomy in Japanese history, that was not a personal interest of mine. I wrote it because I thought it would be an important contribution to the field, and because it would fill a gap in scholarship on Japan. But this time I wanted to indulge myself by researching my current passion, which is animal care. I've been volunteering at an animal rescue facility close to where I live, and I took a course in wildlife rehabilitation, and on weekends I go out looking for wildlife. So I started researching traditional Japanese animal care simply because there's not much out there about it, but also because I take personal pleasure in the topic. I thought even a short introductory book like this one could be informative to nearly everyone since so few people know about this particular topic. So I did want to keep it short and affordable, but also make it accessible to a broad readership. So in these ways, the Asia Shorts series fit those objectives perfectly.
Definitely. Now that you've explained your personal reason behind it, it makes much more sense because some of the things you mentioned in the preface, I was hoping to see more of it in the body, but I guess we'll get into that later. Yeah, and this Asia Short series is such a wonderful series. I feel like any non-scholarly readers can just pick it up and familiarize themselves with topics like this. So it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a big fan of this series myself.
Yeah, me too. So how is this book structured?
It's structured broadly chronologically over six chapters, but it's also organized by categories of animals. So broadly speaking, pets as one category, domesticated animals as a second category, and then wildlife as a third category. Obviously, people cared for these different categories of animals very differently, depending on those respective categories' proximity to humans. So pets, for example, pets often treated like members of the family. They were also status symbols in early Japan. And so pets carry great emotional value, affective value. Domesticated animals, by which I mean livestock, of course, were different. They held great economic value, relatively less emotional value. Interestingly, pre-Meiji veterinary medicine was limited to this single category of animal, animals with great economic value, and talking about horses and cattle specifically. There was no veterinary medicine focused on pets. And then there's a third category, wildlife. And there are two subcategories of wildlife. I suppose you could divide wildlife into noxious animals, that is to say vermin, pets that are to be avoided or eliminated, exterminated. And then the other subcategory, useful wildlife that can be used as meat or for their fur, medicinal products. So wildlife had some material value, but no effective value. So the book discusses these various categories of animals separately, and then how those categories of animals changed historically, changing economic pressures, changing values, of course, reinvented those categories and the attitudes connected with them.
Now, in the book, you mentioned that a discussion of animal care and control may not be a commonly seen topic in Japanese studies, but you argue that a better understanding of Japan's relationship with animal and nature can help us challenge some existing notions. So can you briefly talk about these assumptions, these existing notions that you're trying to challenge in this book?
Yeah, so that's an important question. It gets at the heart of one of the things that I'm doing in this book. And I think how people talk about and think about Japan's treatment of animals closely reflects how they think about Japan and Japanese society more generally. So the history of animal care is very much the history of people. There are several schools of thought about the topic. And I'll just reduce it to two general schools of thought. So essentialistic interpretations, Nihonjinron and this sort of thing, look at Japanese thought and religion, Buddhism and animism and so forth, to claim that humans are one with the natural world, whereas Westerners seek dominion over the natural world. I think many listeners to this program will be familiar with this argument. The evidence for this is the historical prevalence of vegetarianism, the bans on killing issued at various points in Japanese history, and then, of course, Tokugawa Tsunayoshi's compassion edicts prohibiting people from perpetrating any sort of harm upon animals. But the more we learn, the more we find that all of these are highly problematic as historical evidence. The hunting bans were temporary and only applied to certain animals and certain seasons. They sought to promote agriculture, which of course was a source of tax revenue for the government. And then Tsunayoshi's edicts, these were an anomaly. They were universally hated. They were largely ineffective. And they were overturned after his death. I look at them as the exception that proves how dependent Japanese were on animals and animal products. Okay, so that's one school of thinking about this. And then there's the opposite position, which labels Japanese as environmental criminals without any sort of moral conscience and who indiscriminately exploit wildlife for personal gain. You know, most famously, Japanese commercial whaling and dolphin hunting, and then the extinction of Japanese wolves and otters and other species and so forth. And these arguments also note the absence, or in any case, the weakness of animal rights and animal welfare movements in Japan, which they see as evidence of backwardness or incivility and this sort of thing. And this narrative has been around forever, or at least, you know, since the Meiji period, and it still persists today. So we have those two schools of thought. And I think historical accuracy falls somewhere in the middle. The middle narrative is often missing among so much polemical scholarship. Just like everybody else, Japanese have always exploited animals. But at the same time, they've also, I think, tread comparatively lightly on its own environment. So although the topic of the book is animal care, it's also very much a study of Japanese history more broadly. And so, you know, as with everything else, the more we learn, the more effectively we can dismiss the sorts of false assumptions that I just mentioned.
Indeed, and it's such a difficult question to think about. I was completely shocked when I first heard about Japan's consumption of whale and dolphins. I think I was in high school or middle school. But then when I actually talked to some Japanese people from that generation, they didn't even realize what the critiques on them were about, because it was, for them, it was just a normal part of their daily life. I was hearing stories that one of my professors told me that when they were in elementary school, their school lunch would have dolphin meat. And so they never, it never occurred to them that it was seen by countries outside of Japan as a cruel act. And now that their tradition, so to speak, is being challenged, they had that confusion about what to think of their own culture. So I thought that was a really great point that you mentioned in the first chapters of your book. Now, you also get into the discussion of religion, because it played such an important part in animal care since early times in Japan. So what are some of the concepts in Japanese religion that people use to theorize and practice animal control or care?
Yeah, okay. So Japanese veterinary knowledge was, of course, imported from China, introduced from China in the 7th century. But in the process, it was contorted so as not to contradict with existing medical practices and religious practices. So traditional Japanese veterinary medicine then came to consist of a combination of spiritual treatments like prayer and exorcism, but also physical treatments like herbal medicines and moxibustion and needling or acupuncture. But they also depended on the day's animal. So, you know, every day was associated with or connected with one of the animals of the zodiac, the Chinese zodiac, right? So, for example, I give this example in the book, for illnesses or maladies befalling, for example, a horse on the day of the ox, called for application of needling and moxibustion, but also for worshiping the ox deity. This was done by cutting a peach branch of a certain length and then stroking the horse three times with it and then releasing the branch down the river. So I thought this was a good example of how medical treatments combined knowledge of herbal medicine, but also retained a lot of the, religious, pre-existing religious beliefs, connected with healing.
That's interesting. And if, just out of curiosity, how widely were stock animals held in households? Were they usually limited to more wealthy families, or were they just so necessary that each farm family would have one, that kind of thing?
Well, compared to Europe, they were quite rare. You know, they were quite valuable and expensive to keep. And, you know, keeping them required a certain amount of land as well. So it was just the wealthy, it was just the elites that, for the most part, had cattle or oxen for agricultural purposes. Horses were almost exclusively used by the warrior class for warfare. And so these comments, I guess, pertain to early Japan and through the medieval period of Japan. Things changed a little bit. The horses and oxen both became somewhat more prevalent during the Edo period. Western Japan had more oxen or cattle, and Eastern Japan were known more for their horses. But in any case, the short answer to your question is they were commodities that were not really accessible to the common person, the common farmer, for example. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That's really good to know. Now, returning to the topic of veterinary practices, this perspective of veterinary practice is a very innovative and intriguing one for me. So how did veterinary techniques develop over time? As you mentioned, Chinese and Western medicine was introduced to Japan, different time periods, how did these influences change the Japanese tradition of animal healing?
Well, they changed it enormously and fundamentally. The book points out a number of historical continuities in Japanese conceptualizations of animals and care of animals. But veterinary medicine, the modernization, the westernization of veterinary medicine was a major rupture. Of course, you know, it involved overthrowing Chinese medical theory that had been embraced for some 1300 years. And it also overturned the authority of tradition or the need to seek truth in the distant past. Modern veterinary medicine took a completely different approach. It stressed, of course, the scientific method and constantly sought new knowledge and medical advances. So, you know, from the Meiji years, although some individuals continued to practice traditional treatments, herbal medicines, needling, and this sort of thing, bona fide vets, trained vets, were schooled and practiced European or Western veterinary knowledge.
Okay, that's very interesting. And you also mentioned earlier about the tradition of keeping animals as pets. Well, I love pets, so I'd like to talk more about this. From historical materials, we know that early modern Japan, like the shogun that you mentioned, Tsunayoshi, he loved pets. His we can delve more into his regulations about non-killing. But what kinds of pets did people keep, and how were they treated throughout history? And were there any changes or transformations in the ways that they treated or kept pets?
Yeah, there were changes in how people kept pets. Of course, the domestication of dogs in Japan goes back to the Jomon era. We know from Heian period literature that courtiers kept pets. They kept lap dogs. They kept cats as pets as well. Birds were also popular pets in early Japan. And from the medieval period, people held singing contests, or utawase, they were called, for quails and songbirds like warblers. Children, of course, also collected pets, frogs, crickets, other insects. Some people kept mice as pets and even experimented with crossbreeding mice. And so all these pets were treasured, just as pets were treasured today, with the exception, I suppose, of larger dogs, medium-sized and larger dogs, which were generally allowed to roam around the house, roam outside the house, roam through the neighborhoods freely. So there was a rather looser conceptualization of dog ownership back then, which, of course, caused problems because it led to so many stray or semi-feral dogs that became a problem, especially under Tsunayoshi. And then moving into the modern era, yeah, so pet care changed. I suppose you could say it became more westernized. Dogs and cats became the predominant family pet and were kept inside the home, you know, as they often are in the United States and other Western countries. That's how they changed.
So we briefly talked about some of the misconceptions about Tsunayoshi earlier, but for our listeners who might not be familiar with this period of history, can you tell us about what happened and why it takes such an important position in the history of animal care in Japan, Tsunayoshi's regulation on non-killing?
Yeah, well, so again, I view Tsunayoshi's compassion edicts really as an anomaly. And there were some, I think something like 130 of these orders that he issued over the course of his reign as shogun. He was the fifth Tokugawa shogun. And really, draconian punishments were handed out to people who had harmed animals or who had failed to help animals in need, even. People were executed and banished, for example, for those types of transgressions. Of course, people hated these laws. Commoners hated them. But also the samurai class hated not being able to hunt anymore. Daimyo around the country loved their falconry, their hawking, right? And they also loved to hunt deer and other game. And now suddenly they were unable to do this. So really, it angered just about everybody. And it also caused other forms of agricultural upheaval. It led to the proliferation of wild boar and deer and bears, all of which are agricultural pests. And so it had definite economic negative consequences as well.
That's something that we often hear when people try to argue against the critiques on Japan's lack of animal care, is that they would throw out this the tsunayoshi and the non-killing of the Tokugawa period. But for my last question, I do want to focus on your last chapter, as well as something you mentioned in the preface. So there have been various critiques on the ways that Japan treats animals today, whether with whale or dolphin hunting, or even with ivory importing. I actually did not know this until I read your book, that Japan is one of the largest countries of ivory importing, and they have no regulation on this. So when Japan was trying to join the so-called modern nations in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, did animal care modernize as well? Or did Japan's attitude towards animal care and the tradition, more importantly, of animal care change?
It did change, and it did modernize, of course. Like everything else during the Meiji era, it did. Japanese veterinary medicine, as I mentioned, became modern, by which I mean Western. And then, you know, the animal welfare movement, the animal rights movement, this also emerged in the middle of the Meiji period. And it came to reflect Western thinking and values. And as in every, you know, as in every other facet of life, Japan was always racing to catch up with the West, and animal care was no different. And it was always finding itself a step behind the West. And this is a word, this word behind, it's a word I find used to describe Japanese animal care and to define Japanese attitudes about animals. And, you know, I suppose listeners can decide for themselves whether that word behind is fair or unfair. I do want to note, though, I think it's important to realize that Japan learned from the West the very practices that it was later criticized for. You mentioned commercial whaling, ivory imports, trafficking in endangered species, etc. These were all Western industries. They continue to be Western industries. Well, not commercial whaling anymore. And then there are other wildlife industries as well. Zoos, for example. And Japan has the second largest number of zoos in the world. Safari parks, aquariums. You know, Japan is criticized for all of these and how it manages all of these. Then there's the euthanization of cats and dogs in Japan. Of hundreds of thousands of these stray pets or abandoned pets are euthanized in Japan every year. But you know, these are practices that Japan learned from the West. And these are examples of modernization, the modernization of animal care. You know, we're horrified by these practices perhaps today, but nonetheless, you know, these were the accepted standards of animal care in the day. And so this is a case, I think, of modernization becoming a problem, becoming a source of criticism and Japan bashing. And one of the arguments in my book is that there are many important continuities between pre-Meiji and modern Japan. Yes, Japanese attitudes have changed somewhat, but what's often forgotten is how much Western attitudes towards animals have also changed during this time. And in fact, it's the change of Western attitudes that has become more a source of criticism of Japan than Japanese tradition itself.
So this ties to, I guess this is one of the classic case of East against West tradition kind of argument. But fast forward to 2022, not to put more spotlight on your personal opinion here, but how do you view, as an enthusiast of wildlife protection. How do you view the Western critiques on Japan about their lack of animal care even till this day?
Well, the critiques have always been harsh and scathing, and they continue to be today. But, and of, you know, of course, as an academic, I recognize the importance of cultural relativism and remaining objective. But on a personal level, I believe the critiques are warranted and are necessary. You know, we live now, and now all of us are contending with global environmental problems, and biodiversity loss is one of those global problems that affects everybody. And so I think it's past time for everybody, Japan included, and the United States included, to collaborate with the most progressive animal protection, biodiversity protection measures that they can in order to prevent further collapse of biodiversity and mass extinctions. So, you know, as a scholar, I want to remain objective and distanced from this question. As much as I want to do that, though, I do think that harsh criticism is warranted, not just for Japan, but for many other societies as well.
That is so well said. And I'm so glad that your book can bring this view into conversation with studies in Japanese, in the field of Japanese studies.
Well, thank you, Jingyi. It was great to talk to you again.
Thank you. And I look forward to reading your new books next year, I suppose.
Well, we'll see.
I hope that happens. But for our listeners, to find out more about animal care in Japan's early modern history and modernization of Japan's animal care, make sure to check out this new book by Puck Brecker, Animal Care in Japanese Tradition, A Short History. This is Jingyi from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode.